This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to I'm Absolutely Fine, the podcast from The Mid-Adult that looks at all the glamour and indignity of being a grown-up.
Hello everyone, I'm Annabelle and I'm absolutely fine, but the clocks are going forward. Forward, isn't it? Yes, fall back, spring forward, forward this weekend. And I'm really dreading it. I know people go, oh, it's going to be wonderful. I don't think it's going to be wonderful. I think it's going to be another hour of daylight to highlight all my many failures and loneliness.
Oh, dude.
And despair, frankly. I mean, I think it's a vulgarity of fucking sunlight, if you ask me. I don't like the dark either. So clearly I'm a person who can't be made happy. But can it not just get dark at about 6? When it gets to sort of 9, it's just silly.
There were all these memes going on this week, which were like, I don't know who needs to hear this, but, and I'm sure that we've shared them in the past, but it's like, I don't know who needs to hear this, but from next week, the sun will not set at 7 p.m. for the next 7 months or something.
Well, it's not quite that, but yes, exactly. The sun will set no earlier than 7 p.m. Exactly. Till October. I don't want to hear that. I want to be able to curl up, shut the world out, shut my feelings out, and proceed like a battery-operated toy. Is it clear that I'm having trouble accessing my joy at the moment?
Well, Annabelle,
I just said I'd fake it for this podcast and I'd be perky. Well, this is what that looks like. How are you, Em?
Oh, well, I'm absolutely fine. Annabelle, thank you. But I have to say that normally I would be the first cheerleader of the sun setting later and later and later. But I don't know about everybody else, but I feel really lost currently. And it's a really odd feeling because I have all of the good things, you know, a job I love, a family I love, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there is something about the way that this year is developing. And I don't know if it's because I'm picking up on kind of, you know, the sort of the seismic global changes that I feel like, but I feel like I'm in a waiting room for something. Mm. And it's awful because I don't know if I'm in the waiting room for an exam or an examination, or if I'm in the waiting room for something fantastic
yes.
on the other side.
Are you going to be further tested or is the universe going to give you a present? But there is this sort of awful stalemate, isn't there?
Yes, and actually, I spent quite a lot of the weekend sort of thinking, wow, I was sort of watching a movie and thinking, this, from the outside in, this looks great, but why do I not feel like this is as satisfying, relaxing, as fun as it should be? And, well, basically, what am I missing? Anyway, oddly,
let's find out.
Yes, exactly. We are thrilled to welcome Emma Reid Turrell back to the podcast. Now, you might remember she came on to talk about her first book, Please Yourself, which was her manual on how to stop people pleasing, which you also may remember that I found unbelievably helpful.
You're definitely getting crosser.
Yes. Thanks, Emma.
Oh, that's great.
Anyway, well, she's back with another banger. Can we say that about therapy books? I think we're
going to. Yeah, 100%.
Okay. Called What Am I Missing? Which is about our blind spots and how they can hold us back. Now, it is extremely thorough, useful, crisp, and I didn't always feel absolutely fine reading it, I have to say. But we can get onto that. Emma, how are you?
Well, I am absolutely fine. But this morning, the kids are off. It's the Easter holidays. My husband is helping. Did you see the air quotes? Can you hear the air quotes? And he helped this morning by putting on a whitewash, which was great, until I opened it to put it in the tumble dryer and there's one solitary pair of red Mario Kart pants.
No.
So now I'm absolutely fine, but I have a lot of pink clothes.
At least they're pink.
I know. It could be worse, right? You they're mostly his, to be fair.
Well, that's brilliant. Karma. That's yeah. brilliant. Because, you know, because pink is one thing, but when they're like grey or like sort of green.
Mm-mm. Yes. Just a slimy hint of khaki. Well, that's what they were like before they went in, you see. That's our standard wash.
Yeah, it's like it's sort of almost like emotionally, and I think this is for people who feel like this, they could do very well to read your book. I suppose I feel like a sort of child's picture where they've worked on it too long and with too little expertise or technique. And so all the colours have mushed together to form a sort of murky, muddy khaki. Mm. And that is my feelings.
Yes. That's interesting as well, because yes. it's a bit of a combat colour as well.
Yes.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Like the colour of invisibility.
And camouflage, but also battle. Sort of stealth and battle.
Yes. Camouflage, stealth and battle. You're not wrong.
And it's not as fashionable now as it was when All Saints made their cargo pants in that colour and we could wear them.
We could get our belly buttons pierced.
Yes.
In your case, Emily,
again. Yes, I did too.
I sat at Godalming's train station looking at it, bearing in mind I was about 23 at this point, wondering if it was infected, deciding that it possibly wasn't supposed to look as it did. And then the next thing I knew, I woke up from the faint that I had just imposed upon myself on the platform and decided that as I came back to consciousness, perhaps it wasn't for me.
Did you faint from disgust or sepsis?
Total, who knows? But I was so horrified that I think I did the right thing and my brain shut me down and said, no, you need to lie down on the platform.
God, I wish I could fall into a faint now and wake up.
Fall into a faint. It sounds so glamorous.
Well, you know, we hear from people quite a lot who just say, I'd really quite like to be hospitalised for a bit. Nothing life-threatening.
No.
Just a rest, maybe a padded cell, just to be left alone
a week. A week of a menu that just comes along on a trolley.
Jelly.
Now, on to your... Jelly.
Jelly.
It's the first time I've seen you smile today. It's amazing.
Well, you know what I need. Jelly.
Jelly.
On to your banger of a book. Now,
yes.
What's interesting is it, in a way, why you felt the need to write it. And presumably one of the reasons you felt the need to write it, tell me if I'm speaking out of turn, is because you had observed that people were in a pickle, this particular flavour of pickle. And can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, this particular psychological pickle. And that really is exactly what it is. So we've got lots of different types of therapy. We've got lots of different ways of working with people. I would diligently work through all sorts of issues with my clients and they would work hard and they'd engage and they'd take away the insights and they'd practice these different behaviours. And then they'd come back and say, yeah, I don't get it. I don't get it. That didn't work. I'm still having that argument with my mother. I still feel less than in my friendship groups. I'm still being passed up for promotion. I don't get it. What am I missing? And it became this question that was popping up more and more and more of people saying, yeah, there is something just in the shadows, just in my peripheral vision that I know is there. I can't get a handle on it, but I need to face it. So that's what we do.
Very unnerving. Very unnerving to feel there's something just on your shoulder. Like, what are those little floating thing called in your eyes?
Floaters.
Those. Okay, there you go. Brilliant. You can't quite get a handle on what is happening. And also whether it's real or imagined. So it is sort of you're gaslighting yourself.
Totally. Totally. And I think you're gaslighting yourself based on a rule book that you sort of swallow diligently again as a child. So these aren't even your floaters. These are intergenerational floaters that have come down the line to you. I know. Just flush the toilets. That's what we all need to do, guys.
I know, yes.
It's interesting as well because I love what you write at the beginning about how much the brain fills in. So if you're walking down the street, I think you use this as an example. You know, we're filling in sort of 70% of stuff because we can't see. Obviously, we can't see because we don't have 360 vision. And I feel like, of course, you have blind spots in your kind of, you know, if you're walking down the street. So why wouldn't you have emotional blind spots, right? Where you basically, you filled in for whatever reason, how you think that you should behave or how you think you should react or whatever, based on obviously childhood kind of, you know, messaging that you're getting. And then, of course, you go through and then suddenly you're like, well, hold on, why is this not working?
Yes.
Yeah, because 90% of our conscious lives, sort of semi-conscious lives, are... A sort of populated by these assumptions, what we think we know. And then they're both comforting and unhelpful, I think, a lot of time, aren't they?
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And I think the sort of slightly unpopular opinion that I have held for a while is that We're not here to be kind. Being kind actually is doing a disservice to ourselves and others. We need to be responsible and we need to judge. And so part of the origin story of What Am I Missing was seeing events such as George Floyd or Sarah Everard, or understanding what was happening in global crises and trying to get a picture of Caroline Flack, all of these people who are suddenly generating this, we have to be more tolerant, we have to be more understanding. And the bit that was really missing for me was, well, first of all, we need to understand what's actually going on and get a really clear picture, because I believe that judgment is the antidote to prejudice. It needs to be an informed judgment. So What Am I Missing is all about getting the information so that you can feel really confident in the judgments that you then go on to make.
Because otherwise, it's something you talk about in your book, is we spend an awful lot of time in a very useless, unproductive, unhelpful way to ourselves and others feeling guilty.
Yeah.
And I thought this was interesting because we were sort of, you know, some of the received wisdom that we had passed down to us was that depression was anger turned inward. Mm. And you've evolved that to say that really guilt is anger turned inward. Guilt about things that we can't do anything about, or things that we feel that we, you know, need to have done better around.
Yes. So
can you tell us about that?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And you're right. This is a sort of evolution of this idea of what happens when we weren't given permission to be angry when we were growing up, or maybe we didn't see people being angry around us in a useful way. Or maybe they were all angry and so there was no room for our anger. All of that means that we might have ended up with a view of anger that says we can't be angry. It's ugly, it's unproductive, it's destructive. And I talk to clients all the time about the fact that anger is actually the first line in self-preservation. When a baby cries, that is a protest cry. Not because that baby wants to, you know, fuck shit up, but because that baby needs something to be different. It needs to be picked up, cuddled, changed, helped to get back to sleep, fed. All it needs is a change of some sort, and then that feeling passes. And somehow we lose the ability, I think through a lot of conditioning, and particularly for women, we lose that ability to use anger in that really healthy, productive way. Mm-hmm. So we squash it, we sit on it, we become passive aggressive, we direct it back at ourselves, and we feel guilty about things when really what we needed was for something to change. Mm.
So tell us about the profiles.
Okay. So the whole premise of the profiles was that all of these wonderful clients coming in saying, what am I missing? I don't understand what's going on here. They started in my mind over a couple of years to fall into four categories. And those categories were all about their relationship to their needs. So I had one category of client who would say, well, I don't need anything. Then I'd have a category of client who said, no, I do need stuff, but I don't really expect anyone else to do it. So I do it all for myself, or I take it for myself. Then another category that said, I have needs, definitely. I do want other people to help me with them, but I can't ask for them directly to be met. So I have to kind of hint and cajole and persuade. And then this fourth category that was coming all the way down to that, well, I can't even hint and cajole and persuade. I just have to receive what's given to me. Mm. And those started to form my four profiles. So there's the rock who typically is strong, stable, broad-shouldered, self-reliant, independent, can also be quite emotionally avoidant, can also come across as aloof or cold at times, but they have that relationship with needs that says, do you know what? I can go without. I might get busy helping other people with their needs, because that's as close as I'll come to needs, but I won't need anything. Then that second category I talked about was the gladiator. They became my gladiators. I have needs and I'm bloody well gonna get them met, but I won't necessarily be considerate of other people's needs in the way I go about it. So there's a kind of bulldozer quality to them, which means that they can be amazing leaders, really ambitious, really committed, really confident, but sometimes a little cutthroat in the way they go about things. The third category, this one that had this relationship with needs that said, I have needs, I want help, can't ask for it directly. They're my hustlers. These are the ones that have learned how to negotiate their way through life to kind of keep other people happy. There's a people-pleasing overlap with my hustlers. There's that sense of maybe I can drop hints, maybe I can make deposits and get my needs met further down the line if I can cash them in. Maybe I can do things that organise the reactions of other people so that I get what I want. I can charm them. I can be really personable, really creative, really flexible, but not necessarily very direct. So you could say that there are times that they come across as manipulative. And then my fourth category, the one that actually is pretty much just beholden to what's on offer, they're my bridges. And they can be incredibly collaborative, cooperative. They're easygoing, they're laid back, they say yes, they go with the flow, they're really adaptable, but you might not hear their voice. Mm. You might not hear their identity and what they really need. So all of these profiles that come into therapy, they have absolutely superpowers, each of them. And my role as a therapist is saying, but what you might be missing is, and to kind of fill in some of those blanks for them. So what you take away is a fuller picture, greater perspective. My therapeutic goal, greater perspective.
So this is an advertisement from BetterHelp Therapy Online.
Okay, serious question. How many times have you been out recently? Actually, you know, scratch that. How many times have you woken up the day you were supposed to go out and felt flooded with dread? How long have you spent praying that the other person will cancel so you don't have to?
And yet, just as we're avoiding people, so many of us feel really lonely and more tired than ever, particularly now the days are getting a bit longer and you think, how am I going to have the energy to go out into the world?
Our social batteries are very flat at the moment, and that can make us feel isolated, which can lead to trouble. And in my experience, therapy has helped me track my best energy sources and helped me better identify what leaves me feeling depleted.
So if you're thinking of starting therapy, why not give BetterHelp a try?
It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a registered therapist and switch anytime for no additional charge.
With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise.
Listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/midult. That's better, HELP.com/midult.
BetterHelp, because sometimes the best thing to do is acknowledge that we are not, in fact, absolutely fine.
So let's say you're a rock.
Let's say that, Annabelle.
I'll give you a for instance.
Okay.
You're a fucking rock, okay, Emma? And you need to ask, so how do you therapeutically look at that? What questions do you ask? What do you need to acknowledge in order to, you know, kind of dimensionalize your experience? So you're in the world and experiencing the world.
That's a great question. From one rock to another, what I can tell you is, the thing that we are missing or have been missing until, you know, we do the work is vulnerability. It's that piece about how someone can come in to therapy or into a relationship or a friendship or a work scenario and bring more vulnerability, which obviously is not what they've been pre-programmed to do. So it's not going to feel comfortable. And, you know, like you were saying before, Emily, that idea of our brain has done all this filtering already for us, that we're only seeing what we expect to see when we walk down the road. A rock is only going to expect to see people letting them down or disappointing them or criticizing them for their vulnerability or potentially exposing them. So all of the vision that they've got has said, go it alone. So when they come into this space of what am I missing, it's actually, what if intergenerationally there is truth to that you've been let down in the past, but there is still more benefit to opening up some vulnerability for a future that's going to get you where you want to get to.
Let me ask you an idiotic question.
Love it.
Vulnerability is a hell of a buzzword, right? Thanks to the Titanic, Brené Brown probably kicked it off, and onwards and onwards. Vulnerability, I mean, they use it on Love Island, Married at First Sight, Love is Blind. I mean, I watch these shows sort of compulsively.
It's excellent.
It's not good. What is vulnerability and how do you do it?
So now I feel I need to bring in a kind of Married at First Sight reference here and talk about Timothy. Have you been watching Timothy and Lucinda?
Old Tim. Yes, I have.
Did you just call him Old Tim?
They call him Old Tim because
they call him Dad.
Yeah, they do call him Dad.
Literally, I don't know. Does it have...
Yes, so Lucinda is quite new age, extremely in touch with her emotions, has done a lot of work. At the beginning, she feels like quite a lot. And by the time you're a few episodes in, you just sort of adore her and are desperate for her to be happy. She's so generous. She's so loving. And he's lost everything and everyone.
Yeah.
And is terrified, absolutely terrified of Well, connection, really.
Exactly that. And I think, given that we're now case studying Lucinda and Timothy, what she does, which is so brilliant, is offer this unconditional acceptance of him. And she is absolutely gorgeous. I totally agree with you. When I first met her, I thought she probably wouldn't be my cup of tea. Now I would like her in my pocket all
yes,
the time.
I agree.
Because she just represents love. And most rocks, in the nicest possible way, have not experienced that sense of abundant love. Abundant, generous goodwill and love and acceptance. So we've got a little bit too good at not needing it. So part of how we get...
And also being a little bit repulsed by it. He looks like he's going to throw up.
Yeah. And he gets mean. And I think that's one of the real defence mechanisms, isn't it? It's the self-preservation. So she's offering him love and he's putting all his walls up saying no. And he criticises her and says that, what does he say? That she needs to wear a t-shirt when she comes to bed. And she does this brilliant thing of saying, well, you've got boobs too.
Yeah. She does. Love in the end, episode. There's a point where she just goes, I'm not here for this.
No. And I loved that. And have you noticed it's changed things? Anyway, I don't want to give any spoilers because somebody might still be desperate to watch from the beginning. And so you should. But what's amazing is that how he is becoming more open to connection relationship is by having her vulnerability. Mm. And she's very patient. She's very calm. She doesn't often take it personally or rise to his defences. She sees him as exactly that. As a parent of a teenager, I can also see that for them to be vulnerable with me, I need to continually be this kind of, it's okay. I'm big enough and ugly enough that I can contain the shit that you're bringing to me today. You go ahead, you be vulnerable, and I won't shame you for it. Mm. And I think the rocks among us have had experiences in our portfolios where we've been shamed for being vulnerable. So I would say, find someone you trust and show your workings out. That sounds like a strange thing to say, but it's like instead of being in your maths lesson as a kid and saying, here's the answer, I've worked it out, which is what a rock does. I've worked it out, I did it by myself. It's show your workings out.
Let yes, because if you see. Provide the answer, what you're doing is presenting your pre-packaged self, right?
Mm. Yeah.
With a nice bow, you know, with quite a complicated knot, so it's going to be quite hard to undo.
Yes, yes.
And here you go, this is what you're getting.
Yeah, or you hit them with a really shitty stick and you say, this is the conclusion, this is right, this is accurate. Mm. And actually what we want to show people instead is, here's how I've come to this point of view. And that helps people say, ah, yeah, I get it. If that were true, of course you would think that. But can I tell you actually what you might have been missing in what you saw in my facial expression or the fact that I didn't reply to your text that day? So you get more information and more alternatives, and then you can work out actually sort of how to hand over your parcel as it is without this kind of Fort Knox you build around it.
Mm. How does it feel for a rock to ask for help?
Like... Feel? Feel? Feel, you say.
I'm sorry, just the little bridge slash hustler over here.
You're a bristle.
Yes, exactly. I think a bristler.
Yes.
But no, just interested in how those, well, I mean, how does anyone ask for help?
Well, I think this is the thing, isn't it, right? It's that asking for help is, and sometimes I break this down into what sounds like a real 101 of communication, but it's about saying three things. So I talk about this, that I see, I feel, I need. And this is a really great way, particularly for rocks and gladiators, because they have some process in common. You're absolutely right, hustlers and bridges, they often have a bit of overlap there too. But when I talk to my rocks and my gladiators, my radiators, I get to say to them, you need to let people know that you see them. It's like, okay, I see that you're having a really busy week at work and that you've got a lot on your plate. I feel missed when you don't reply to my question about what time we're meeting or what the plan is. And I need us to fix that date or agree that we're not going to meet this week. And there's something about being able to say, I see you, so I'm accounting for you. I feel, that's my vulnerability, and I need. So this is me stating my need and what I want. And I think hustlers and bridges can really do well with that as well, because they tend to go, I see you, and that's the end of it.
Yes,
so let's just do you.
Exactly. No, completely. I mean, very much like the way that I felt when I read Please Yourself, but is that, you know, I do so much negotiating for what I see as my space, if I even ask for it at all. But as a result, you know, I feel resentful or I feel exhausted from the lack of directness. And actually, you know, I don't want to say the older I get, but you also have this sort of odd thing happening where I give less of a shit about the reactions as well. So I feel very blunt when, you know, accidentally blunt. Like I've asked for something and I go, oh God, I didn't mean to do that. But it's because I'm also tired of my bridge hustling. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yes, completely.
It's a sort of odd space that I find myself in where I'm like, okay.
It's a complete catch-22.
Presumably exhaustion is quite symptomatic of when you're missing something, when you're missing quite a lot, and you're being run by all these assumptions. Totally. Presumably, I don't know, I certainly feel it. People come to you and say, I'm so fucking tired.
Yes, burnout. I think that's a really great symptom. I often say that burnout is not something to be, it's not something to be kind of feared or vilified. Burnout is this fantastic signal when your body goes, no, no more, you are done. And I think at that point, if you can ask yourself the question, what am I missing? You can get huge insight. Whereas so many of us, I think, find that, oh, right, burnout, how quickly can I get back to doing things the way that I used to do them? But in that moment when you're feeling absolutely exhausted, tiredness, actually, this is my slight segue, tiredness, boredom, frustration, these are all typically symptoms of unfelt anger. So exhaustion is a classic unfelt anger symptom. And the what you're missing is typically, well, this isn't working for me. This needs to change.
And presumably with burnout, you, if you're a rock or a gladiator, then you think, I can't burn out because I've got to fucking do everything.
Yeah.
And if you're a radiator, you think, I can't burn out because I have to be here for them or whatever it might be. So it feels as though stopping is never an option if you're really under the, if you're carrying the weight of these things on your shoulders.
Yeah, totally. And I think the reality is your body will stop you.
Yeah.
And that's what I often see in the therapy room is, I've been to the doctor, I've got stomach ulcers. I thought I was having a heart attack. He said that it was anxiety. I've come up with this autoimmune condition. I'm now in a situation where I'm experiencing my body literally fighting itself. And all of those symptoms, or if it's IBS or if it's migraines, or if it's the menopause, so many physiological symptoms can tell us so much about our psychological blind spots, because we've got this far without knowing, but our body won't take us any further. Menopause for me has been a massive one in terms of, this isn't going to work anymore the way it used to work.
Yeah.
It has to be different now.
It's interesting as well, because when I sort of experienced my kind of first or second midlife crisis, age sort of 39, 40, it was very much, I experienced this panic attack. So I experienced it as a very elevated kind of sense of frenzy, adrenalized sort of thing. Whereas now, age 49, soon to be 50, I've got the, it was a different explanation of fight or flight. It was flop, fatigue, freeze. Yeah. And I think so instead of having that adrenalized one, I'm having a sort of almost like a sort of numbing is the wrong word, but it just sort of, I'm just going to lie there like a sort of Victorian consumptive.
And with a tartan blanket on your lap.
Exactly. And maybe a bit of fruit anyway, and some milk. But but it's interesting. I feel like, yes, exactly. So the old ways that I can't seem to rev myself up like I did in my late 30s. To panic.
It's a different, to get things different done. Sort of flavour of distress.
Exactly. So now I'm just like, oh, maybe it's okay to watch another teen high school movie by myself.
Yes. Episode of Married at First Sight Australia.
Yes.
Or whatever.
It is all right.
It's always all right, isn't it?
It's educational.
Yeah, if you said so, then it's completely fine.
But you know what I mean? It's sort of like, it's, and so exactly like you said, I feel like, again, that lost feeling that I was talking about at the beginning, it's partly because I know that the old ways aren't working, even though I'm much more self-aware than I was at 39, having had therapy and whatever. But I'm still, it's amazing how you can still get yourself caught out.
It's amazing to still not know.
Yes, so annoying.
I know. And it really is the kind of when the shit hits the fan, that is the point at which all of those blind spot gremlins come back out. So I talk in the book a lot about when you're sort of diagnosing yourself, or your partner, or your friend, or a parent, it's not you on your best day. It's not you when you're feeling really balanced and, you know, at a point in your month that's super calm. And it's the bit where you feel fried and frazzled and someone, you know, pushes your last button. That's when you notice your blind spot profile. Mm. It's in that relationship, in your romantic relationship, when you're having the same argument about the red pants in the white wash. That's when you notice yourself go to your blind spot profile. Yeah. And those are the bits that I think are really interesting, because we can all have those great days and that's brilliant, but it's really helpful to ask yourself, what am I missing on the days that you don't feel good? In fact, I'm not bringing this all back to menopause, but that is slightly where I'm at the moment in my own head. Part of what people say to me quite often is, ignore me, I'm premenstrual. And then I kind of crack my knuckles and say, great, let's hear it then. Because yeah. That's the point at which you're going to really hear what they've been missing.
People talk about attachment styles in quite an annoying way, you know. And so it's become quite an annoying thing, which is a shame because it's a sort of essential thing. I mean, to what extent do you think that these profiles relate to individual attachment styles? And also, can you tell us, please, to make it less annoying and more, you know, digestible, about the mice?
The mice. I love the mice. In fact, let me just tell you about the mice first.
Go on then.
That's all we ever need to know about attachment styles. This was a beautiful story that my supervisor told me. And she said one day, the thing is about attachment styles, really, we're going to talk about these three. She said, there's the secure attachment style. And then we understand that, you know, I don't know if I've ever actually met anyone with a secure attachment style. But anyway, the others are much more about these insecure attachment styles. And she talked about ambivalent and avoidant, different ways of doing things. And she said, but I want you to think of each of those as a mouse. And each of those types is a different mouse having a different relationship with its own cheese machine. And she said, what you'll find is that the secure mouse goes up to his or her cheese machine, hits the button when they're hungry, cheese pops out, their tummies are full, they're fed, they can go about their mousy business for the day, safe in the knowledge that every time they hit the button, their needs gonna be met, they'll be fed. When they don't hit the button, nothing happens, nothing weird there, but it's just a really predictable relationship with getting their needs met. Lucky mouse. Then she said, there's this other type of mouse. And this was the one that we talked about as ambivalent. Now that mouse comes up to its cheese machine, hits the button, cheese comes out. Hits the button again, no cheese comes out. Doesn't hit the button, nothing happens. Doesn't hit the button, suddenly cheese is flying everywhere. What this mouse cannot do is have any predictable, reliable relationship with the supply or its needs. So what that mouse has to do, it's really hover and hang around and orbit that cheese machine. Keep hitting the button. Keep hitting the button, because sometimes you're going to need it and it won't deliver. So keep being this kind of what society would call a needy little mouse that's there just demanding cheese all the time. Stockpiling cheese, not necessarily even eating it, letting that cheese go off and not in a good way. This is something about this mouse that has to be constantly asking, needing. Then we have our third type. This is that avoidant mouse. That mouse went up to its cheese machine, hit the button, nothing came out. Its tummy rumbled, it hit the button again, still nothing happened. No matter what that mouse did, hit the button, not hit the button, there was no cheese, there was no food, there was no supply. That mouse then had to make a decision. Do I hang around this either withholding or empty cheese machine and feel this horrible hunger? Or do I work out how to switch off the feeling of hunger altogether so that I don't need to be anywhere near this bloody cheese machine? And that's what the avoidant mouse does. It fucks off into the wilderness, never to look back and need cheese again. And it will avoid cheese machines in its life, particularly ones that start to look like they might withhold. So the minute a cheese machine withholds from it in future, it will burn to the ground that relationship and move on. So they are our mice. And I love that story because I thought, yes, I know that avoidant mouse. I know it well. And to your question, Emily, about the profiles, yes, you can overlay them. We know that that rock tends to be a more avoidant mouse. And we know that our hustlers tend to be much more ambivalent. They have that relationship where they still hope that there's going to be some cheese if they play their cards right.
Listening to you talk about that, I would expect that most people, or quite a lot of sort of society, is in the ambivalent section.
Yeah.
In the sense that we're all trying to, let's say, if society is the big cheese machine, we're all sort of scrabbling around trying to work out where we can get what we can. But maybe that's just,
Spoken like a true ambivalent hustler. Spoken like a true hustler. Because this is the thing. I mean, but you're absolutely right. I think there are swathes of society. I think you can make a gender generalisation. You can make generational generalisations about how people have learned to relate to cheese machines. For me, you know, my mother's Swedish, there is a kind of Viking quality, a rocky quality that comes through that line of my family that says, you know, needs are basically weaknesses.
Yeah.
So this is where we get that point back to burnout. I often say to clients, if you have burnt out, it is not because you're weak. It's because you are so strong that you have taken so much responsibility, that you have then been given so much responsibility, that actually it got to a point where you couldn't carry on. That's not the same as weakness. That's an overload of someone who is incredibly capable. And actually, it's normally at that point, and I suppose this is how we work with vulnerability, it's like, can I join you where you are first so that you feel understood, and then introduce you to what a more vulnerable way of relating might be. If I said to them, you're just doing too much, that's criticism, and that's what that cheese machine used to do.
Can we talk about nice guy syndrome?
Oh, nice guys.
You know, because nice guy. Do we though?
Oh, well, I mean, I can't stand them. But I think genuinely there is something as well about, and I love the dynamic between you two, and we joke about the fact that there's kind of a rock and a hustler here, but rocks are quite often really discombobulated by hustlers. Because they don't have an ability to hustle themselves. They're great. They can stretch. They can lean. So they can become more gladiator-like, more front foot. And I've met plenty of rocks, who I then get to call ridges, who have an ability to kind of be strong and passive, or actually just to go small and passive. But they stay on that side. What I find rocks struggle to do is to hustle. They can't learn to hustle because this is this kind of shapeshifter that is hard for them to kind of pin down and trust. So they love the hustler because the hustler represents creativity and play and spontaneity and this generosity of spirit. But it's very hard for them to interject.
Well, it's also, as the Married at First Sight judges would say, quite confronting.
It's quite confronting.
Because what's reflected back at you is something you can't do, someone you can't be.
No, you can't synthesize this willingness to engage in the world. Like, you've cauterized yours in your early life, or so we think. Actually, we haven't. It's just in a blind spot. And that's why it's this, I mean, hustler. My best friend is, I call her a bristle because she is a kind of hustler and a bridge. And she's so relentlessly loving with me that she can break down those walls that come up for me if I'm feeling particularly defensive that day. My husband's also a bristle. I think there's no surprise that we end up kind of finding our complementary counterparts in relationships.
But what about these nice guys?
These nice guys. So we know nice guys, right? This is nice guy syndrome. This is the one, and I take a very literal example of it, and I put it into the book about the guy that is so friendly and kind and funny and patient and generous and loving. They buy you dinner and they pay you compliments. And then actually, when you say goodnight to them at the end of the evening, they are venomous. They are raging because they want to cash in their chips now. And you are having the audacity to not reciprocate. This is outrageous. That extreme version of the nice guy that we might understand in society, I bring actually back to this much more grassroots level, which is we all have a bit of nice guy in us. And it's nothing to do with whether you're a guy, and it's nothing to do whether it's going to be a kind of a sexual favour you want to cash in. This is about the people that make their down payments on the world.
Yes.
And they make these investments without being honest and upfront about the contract that they're creating. And then when they don't get their needs met in return, they are harsh and aggressive about the lack of reciprocity. And as much as I love my hustlers, it's the hustlers I see do it. Mm-hmm. Because they're the ones who haven't necessarily been upfront about what they want or what their expectation is or what reciprocity is going to look like. So I see them maybe in a work setting where they stayed late every day this week and now they want to leave early to pick their kids up and their manager says they can't because there's a meeting that requires their attendance. But that's outrageous because I did this, therefore I deserve that.
It's another example of your assumptions, really, isn't it? Because they're creating one half of an emotional transaction.
Yes. Totally.
And then they're furious and horrified and feel a great sense of injustice when the other person hasn't recognised and responded in the way that they had anticipated and planned.
Yeah, absolutely. You're so right. And one of the, you know, I said about the I see, I feel, I need. One of the other communication 101 techniques I teach is that when you, I feel, and I think, And what that means is when you say, I can't leave early to pick my kids up, I think you're taking the piss and you don't appreciate all the work I do. And I feel dismissed or overlooked or angry. And the I think is the really crucial bit because it's the bit where I get to say, and this can be in a romantic relationship, if you can communicate the what you think, which is the assumption, the other person's going to be able to hear, well, of course you feel completely dismissed if what you are thinking, if what you're assuming is that me saying you can't pick your kids up is because I matter and you don't. But it's a bit like this showing your workings out because then the other person gets to say, ah, well, when you offer to stay late, I think you're doing that willingly and I feel confused when you're cross with me for wanting you to be at the meeting. So much of this is about assumptions and drawing conclusions, like we said, based on tunnel vision and actually based on the past.
And based also on what you call our inner critic, who you say we're going to need to like schmooze a bit and suck up to a bit and familiarise ourselves with a bit and make friends with our inner critic, right?
Yeah, make friends. And that's, I mean, but this is it, right? This is the inner critic. I have so much love for the inner critic because the inner critic is not that kind of witchy parent voice that may well have actually been around us when we were growing up or may well have taught us at school or may have been an early boss at work. The inner critic is a very little part of you that is trying so bloody hard to keep you safe. Their only interest is keeping you safe. It's just that they're running it on a past system. Yes, you needed to be like this in your family of origin or when you were little and had no power. But as an adult, what I encourage people to do is have that conversation with their inner critic and say, I totally get it. Thank you. Again, sounds really counterintuitive, but thank you. Because what you've done has got us here, but it won't get us there. I'm going to take over now. I've got this.
I mean, you know, it's a healthy grown-up. Imagine that. Sort of, you know.
Right, making decisions for us.
Which I think makes absolute sense in terms of what I think I'm feeling currently. Because it's not about my inner child desperate to kind of like be heard or seen or whatever, which is how I felt in my late 30s. Now it's exactly that. It's the sensible balance voice that's thinking, hold on, something is going on here and I think maybe we should have a look at it. And maybe that's what's... It's coming from a place of not lethargy, actually sort of coming from a place of calm as opposed to a place of kind of, you know, toddler tantrum.
Yeah, or panic, internally. You know, which is all the toddler tantrum is anyway. It's like, do I exist?
Yes.
And so we panic. But actually, if we can drop the panic being fear of fear, if we can recognise actually that we can process fear differently, we can use reassurance, we can find out, we can resource ourselves, then we don't need to get scared.
Yes.
That's interesting because I think you were totally run by panic and I think you were asking, do I exist?
Yes.
And I think hearing the voices was a reflection of needing feedback.
Yes.
Needing psychological feedback. And this has a very different flavour, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Keep saying flavour. It's probably because I'm hungry.
Yeah. What flavour was it? Prawn cocktail?
I don't know. Salt and vinegar.
Yes, exactly. Salt and vinegar. I would urge anyone who's curious about their own assumptions to read this book, because it's incredibly helpful and sort of comforting and only gently challenging.
Ever so slightly confronting. Yeah. In a sort of a married at first sight, in a Mel Schilling way. You know, not with a kind of Alessandra grit. I think this is just a Mel. She's warm. Yeah. She wants the best for you.
Yeah,
she does. Definitely.
And so all we have to say is thank you so much, Emma, the sensational Emma Reid Tunnell, for coming to talk to us again. Please come back and talk to us again and again and again.
Yeah. Yes. Please write more books. No pressure.
Okay.
Yeah. Are you writing another book yet?
Not yet, but I have just done the process of actually taking down all of my Beautiful Mind notes from my office, which means I have a blank wall.
Ah.
So I get to start thinking again, which I'm really looking forward to.
The fertile void.
Exactly.
Well, very good luck with this one, because it deserves all the success in the world, as do you. And we hope to talk to you very soon.
Oh, yeah. Can't wait. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Annabel Rifkin and Emily McMeekin of The Midult. Our book, I'm Absolutely Fine, is out now. If you like what you hear, please rate, review and subscribe.